Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Thank you very much for listening, downloading, subscribing, rating, reviewing, whatever it is you're doing. It always helps when you rate and review the pod, tell your friends, tell your enemies, all that sort of stuff. Anyway, that's enough of me flogging. The interview today is with Ed Madronich Jr. I'm sure I mispronounced his name. Madronich. No, I got that right. President of Flat Rock Cellars, a Niagara-based winery. They are a Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Riesling sort of establishment. I'll tell you a little bit more about one of their Rieslings that I picked up at the LCBO for not a lot of money, like $18, and it was really good. I'll get into that in a bit. But I wanted to bring up sort of an interesting and difficult debate that I've been having. So I'm a part of, with my girlfriend and her twin sister and another friend, it's called Wine Bottle Travels. It's a little side project that my girlfriend started up. She's a flight attendant, so not a lot of work right now. She works for Porter. But we've traveled all around the world, and we got a lot of, you know, photos from wineries and wines we've tried from, you know, France and Italy and New Zealand and all over Ontario and British Columbia. But anyway. So she started a Instagram account called Wine Bottle Travels, and it looks great. It's a lot of great pictures with places to go and visit, wines to try, and it looks good. It looks far better than anything I do. If you ever see my Instagram account, it's a disgrace, mostly because I have a BlackBerry. I'm bad at photos. I take the one photo. I'm like, good, I'm done. And then, yeah, my girlfriend gets angry and takes a much better photo, and then I agree that hers is 100 times better than mine, and we move on. But we were doing a tour of Prince Edward County, and we went to a lot of the places that you've heard if you're a regular listener. Long Dog, obviously, Grange, Rose Hall Run, the girls went to Hinterland, Lighthall. We hit a bunch of places. But we also went to Norm Hardy. We posted a quick video of us with some of the work there. Guy Chris, who was great. Trying some of the funky wines and just talking about it. It was just a quick little video. And someone reached out on Instagram, just messaged and said, are you okay with this? Are you comfortable with this? Do you know the history of Norm Hardy? And I do know that back in 2018, about 20 or 21 women, and this was part of an investigation, I believe the Globe and Mail started this, came out and said that Norm had been lecherous, abusive. There's a lot of different adjectives out there, and I'm sure a lot of them apply. And then it sort of goes to this debate. It's something that I struggle with, and I'd love to get everyone who listens their opinions on this. And you can always hit me up on Twitter at mcause56, and my Instagram is Matthew Cause. But we went there because we wanted to support all the people employed by Norm Hardy. And trying to support the people that are also like the people from that are hired to pick the grapes. And one thing that is always interesting is a lot of the people out there in the vineyards, either picking the grapes or doing the pruning, they're the same people that are hired every year. And some of them are farmers that come in from Mexico or all other parts of North America. These people come each and every season or vintage, excuse me, because they know the soil. They know the vineyards. These are people that truly get whatever winery is trying to express from the land. And a place as big as Norm Hardy employs a lot of people. A lot of people rely on that winery to survive and thrive for their own economic well-being. But the debate is a legitimate one. Can you support all the people surrounding the winery, all the other winemakers, all the people that work in the restaurants and the tasting rooms and the people that work out in the fields? Can you support them, but at the same time still support the 20 women or so that have accused Norm Hardy of a variety of claims of harassment? And then this debate goes into crime and punishment and the idea of rehabilitation. This happened in 2018. There were no charges laid. That doesn't mean that Hardy isn't guilty of some really bad things. And when you read about it, when you hear about people that I know in the biz, you know, I've heard, you know, some unsavory things. So clearly shitty things, you know, happened to women, probably a lot of young women trying to make it in the business. But do you allow for people to learn, to change, for reinvention? Do you believe in rehabilitation? Do you believe in second chances? How do you support and believe the victims and yet try to support so many people connected to the winery? Also embrace the idea that people can change. And I don't know if Norm has or hasn't. I don't know if he deserves another chance. You know, there's part of me that wishes that he would walk away, change the name, but everything else stays the same. But then also, don't we need all the evidence? But then by demanding all the evidence, on some level, are you saying you don't believe the victims? It's hard. You could say this, clearly, no matter what happens, I can only hope for proper restitution, whatever a positive final impact looks like. I hope it happens. I hope the women that he prayed after, that he went after, even if it's something simple as just, nothing is simple. I shouldn't put it like that, but for every woman out there that he said a demeaning line to or came on to or any sort of unnecessary sexual come-ons, I hope every woman is able to recover and whatever recovery looks like. I hope all of them will still work in this business and thrive and hopefully can find work and are not held back by this. But as for punishment, at the very least, you know that the winery lost business. You know that money was lost. And that Norm Hardy's name, it's always going to be connected to these allegations, to a very thorough investigation by the Globe and Mail. So this is the big conflict, because he is a gatekeeper of power in a business where alcohol is such a big part. And when alcohol is a big part and people are out and partying or, you know, whatever the environment is, bad things can happen. Usually they're going to happen to women. Usually they're going to happen to young women. Usually they're going to happen to women who want to get in the business, and it's going to be perpetrated by men in a position of power. I should say I acknowledge, you know, my own blind spots to this. There's probably a lot of this perspective I don't get. I'm a 45-year-old guy. I've never had to deal with sexism. I've obviously never been objectified in that if I didn't play along, I couldn't move ahead in the business. There are all these things that I have this privilege of never being exposed to. On the other end, I don't have all the info. I don't know specifically what he did. Has he reached out to the victims? Has he tried to change? What is the environment like now in his winery? Is it any different? Where are we now with the investigations? I haven't heard anything in 2 years. And again, I say all of this question, where are we now? What's going on with this case? And I'm saying that without trying to sound like I don't believe the victims. Clearly, bad things happened. I should also say, until last weekend, I hadn't visited Hardy. I hadn't bought any wine. I bought a bottle of their Chardonnay. So I hadn't supported the winery in the last couple of years. I just felt that, you know, when the girls decided to put this video together, I mean, Hardy is such like that winery is an important part of the history and where Ontario wine is. So we went there. You know, through the years, I've supported so many great other Ontario wineries. So I guess my question is, and I'm sorry, I'm rambling now, but this is sort of just train of thought and my own way of trying to deal with this. And I don't have an answer. I don't know if there's a 100% definitive answer, but again, I would love to hear people's opinions on this. So I'm open to change. I'm open to have my mind changed and open to hearing any information and different perspectives than my own. So I guess in the end, it comes down to, by offering support to the winery, have we done a disservice to the women who have bravely come forward to tell their story of abuse at the hands of Norm Hardy. Anyway, sorry, that was heavy. You know, just something that has been on my mind and something that I wanted to throw out there. And so again, love to hear your opinion. Awkwardly transitioning to something completely different. I had not really tried many of the wines of Flat Rock Cellars. I've read about them, great reputation, and I hope in the near future to, you know, really experience their wide range of wines. Now, talking to Ed, one thing about him is you will definitely, listening to the interview, this guy is so passionate about Ontario wine and the potential of it, and explaining in such simple reasons why paying $30-$35 for a bottle of wine from Ontario makes sense. And it's not a ripoff. It's not cheap. It's not something most of us can afford to buy and drink on a regular basis. But low yields, hand-picked grapes, you know, doing things the right way, I get it. I have tried their Riesling, which is like $17-$18, and it was really good. Like just juicy orange, this minerally sparkle on it, zippy lime zest. I had it a little while ago, and I was having it at the cottage with some friends and family, just our small little bubble. People make fun of me. I'm sitting there drinking the wine, just trying to enjoy the afternoon after my show was done. I'm making a couple notes. So this was from a little while ago, but those are the three things I wanted to capture: juicy orange, minerally sparkle, zippy lime zest. And it was an enjoyable glass of Riesling. I think it was around like $18, certainly well worth it. So thank you for everyone for putting up with that sort of a little bit longer monologue, but just, you know, something I wanted to get off my chest. And, you know, again, would love to hear different opinions and thoughts and, you know, what I could do different. And again, I'm always open to learning and gaining new perspective. So without further ado, the president, he is the junior. His dad was the one who started it all. But now enjoy my interview with the president of Flat Rock Cellars. Here is Ed Madronich.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Join me now, the president of Flat Rock Cellars. It is Ed Madronich. Ed, thanks so much for doing the pod.
Great to be here.
So let's, I want to go all over the place a little bit about your journey and obviously talk about the wine. You know what? I'm going to go in a different order. Usually I do journey, but I was on your website today and I noticed you're selling one of your 2013 Pinot. And I was wondering how that seems a little bit more rare. Like you don't often see that in New World wineries where one of the wines that's being sold already has 7 years of age on it. I'm curious about the decision to usually a wine like that would already be out of stock.
Yeah. And so what we do, I think at the heart of it, I believe wine is about the experience. And sometimes just the newest, latest vintage isn't giving you the whole wine experience. And we hold back some wines and we'll release them when we think they're tasting amazing. And I think sometimes we always release wines too early, and every wine region does.
Yep.
It's the economics, I'll say, of wine. You have such a big investment that you need to sell your current vintages. Some of the hard experiences that you can never get unless you save is very difficult to obtain. And so we'll release them when we think they're ready. And we do cool things, not just wines that are available to purchase, but we did one of the coolest tastings I don't think you could have done anywhere else in the world last year in the summer at the winery. And we did three different vintages of four of our different wines. So we had our Gravity Pinot Noir, three different vintages going back to 2009. We had our Rusty Shed Chardonnay going back to 2006. We had our Riddled Sparkling going back to 2010. And our Natchez Vineyard going back to, I think, 2005, and had three vintages. So you could come for the evening, taste, four different wines, but, you know, from a 2016 vintage, a 2012 vintage, and a 2006 vintage. And it was such an amazing experience. But wineries don't hold back wines all that often, and so you never get the chance to do that.
Yeah, I noticed that. And there's some like Southbrook, some of their Chardonnays, you can get some of their older wines.
Yes, absolutely.
Which I found cool. You know what the great thing about a tasting like that is it really, I think, hammers home for people that are just new to wine, just not only vintage variation, what that means, but it also shows that, oh, wait a minute. Oh, Ontario wine. Oh, it can be 14 years old and develop. It's not some novelty. You got to drink it as fast as you would a Beaujolais Nouveau. Like, I think that helps the overall integrity and of this region.
Yeah, I don't think a wine region, and I believe Ontario is a great wine region, and I say great unapologetically. And
I agree.
Reasons why.
I agree.
And one of the things that makes a great wine region is the ability of wines to age. If the wine region can't age wines, I think it can't be a great wine region. So you think of Bordeaux or Burgundy or Barolo or wherever, and the wines have the ability to age. One of the things that I'm finding, I'm selling wine now, our first vintage was 03, so we're now 17 vintages in, and I can go back and pull out, I had the 03 Chardonnay not that long ago, and still alive. I don't think I've had an 03 Riesling recently, but I've had an 04 Riesling. It has another 15 years to go. And I think that is, and people have no idea how great the soil is and the climate is in Ontario for us to make age-worthy wines. It's amazing.
I think maybe part of it is that Ontario, except maybe in certain vintages, we're not going to make the big Cabernet Sauvignon, but neither does Burgundy. And between the Pinot, the Chardonnay,
The Riesling. I mean that, right. And also I'll throw in Syrah and Cab Franc. I'll absolutely throw in Cab Franc as well. There's more than enough for Ontario to hold its hat on against any region.
Yeah. And I think what I think everybody is starting to realize for Ontario, but it's true of every wine region in the world, is that no wine region does every grape variety well.
Yeah.
There's a reason why Napa Valley does not grow Riesling, right? There you can get the odd one, but you know, it's not known as a Riesling area because it wouldn't produce great Riesling, but it makes amazing Cabs, right? And it's why Burgundy does not do Cabernet Sauvignon, because they do amazing Pinots and Chards, right? When you think of Australia, and I'm generalizing, so don't, yeah, it's a very general, you know, you think of Shiraz, right? When you think of New Zealand, you think of Sauvignon Blanc. Why? Because those are the varieties they do well, and they can do economically well, right? So I'll give Syrah, for example. I think Ontario can make some killer Syrah. The problem is our winters are too cold, and economically, it does not make economic sense to grow Syrah in Ontario, right? And so there's an economic side, and there is the grape growing side, and those two things got to combine. What we do really well is Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Riesling. And, you know, that should be our focus, right? And you can throw in a few others, Cab Franc or whatever. But we need to focus in on the varieties that we can do well here in Ontario.
Oh, yeah. And I feel like I used to see more Cabernet, so Ontario Cabernet Sauvignon, maybe a decade ago when it was about economics. Like, okay, sell this grape. Everyone knows it. And I'm glad I see less of it, because we just don't have the summers for it. And maybe, you know, a small little one single vineyard in a hot year can make a good one, but that's still rare.
Yeah, and I think you probably are seeing less. I always like to sort of imagine the story is, you know, 30, 40 years ago, when there was 6 or 8 wineries in Ontario, they all got together and they said they were going to do every grape variety under the sun, and that's going to be their strategy. And since then, we start taking away the ones that don't work very well for climatic reasons, or ripening reasons and things like that. And we've narrowed it down to a handful of varieties that we do well in Ontario. And just to comment on your Cabernet Sauvignon, you probably are seeing less red Cabernet Sauvignon, but a lot of that is probably going into rosés now. Interesting.
Yeah.
So rather than ripping out a vineyard, you're probably seeing a lot of rosés made with Cabernet Sauvignon, interestingly enough, here.
So on your bio, Ed, it says, Ed credits a summer in France and exposure to a few choice bottles of wine for his passion. So take me to that summer in France, and what were the wines?
Okay, so the funny part about it is you got to imagine, I am now a 19-year-old basketball player at McMaster University, into sports, and not necessarily a wine, well, definitely not a wine drinker, but a friend of I and I went over to France, actually went over to Europe. We flew to England, and we had saved up some money in the first couple months of summer, and my parents had bought me a Canada 3000 ticket to Europe. And we didn't have any money for a Eurorail pass, so we decided to ride our bikes. We rode from London and then we took the ferry over to Holland, then we rode down through Paris, and we're driving down the N7 to get to southern France on our bikes, and there was a sign that said dégustation. And I'm like, Mike, I think we can drink for free, right? And because we had no money. And so we pull over, we knock on the door, and this old man answers the door, and he's very apologetic, trying to speak English. Oh, I'm sorry, I don't speak English, but come in, and my son's not here, and so obviously his son was running the domain at the time, and we proceeded to go through a whole bunch of wine. And I learned 3 things that day. I learned, one, that I liked wine. So the stuff that I was stealing from my parents' fridge at the time was clearly not very good. And this in Southern Burgundy was much better. The second thing I learned was wine is a social lubricant. And I learned that wine is a social lubricant because during that experience, here was this 85-year-old man who didn't speak a lick of English when we got there because he was apologizing and I was struggling with my French. By the time we finished our 2, 3, 4 bottles of wine, whatever it was, fluent English, right? he probably could speak English, but he probably hadn't done it in 20 years because his son was running the domain. And the last thing I learned was, and this to me is what I do. The last thing I learned is here was this 85-year-old man with two kids on bicycles with no money. And he didn't really care. All he wanted to do was share his passion for wine with us. And that to me is what I think I try and do at Flat Rock Cellars. Is it's not about selling wine. It's not about making wine. It's about sharing my passion for wine with our customers, right? And it's things like giving them access to older vintages and things like that. Those are the things that I'll say motivate and drive me, is really to share that passion for the craftsmanship that everybody at the winery takes in making our wine.
Yeah, because it's you're not going to get super rich, owning a winery, and the hours are very long. What would you say stylistically is the philosophy? What is your philosophy? You and obviously your father first at Flat Rock.
Yeah. So stylistically for me, what we're trying to, so I believe the best wines in the world are balanced wines. When you taste a wine, you shouldn't be saying, oh my God, it's got a lot of sugar, or it's got a lot of acid, or it's got a lot of oak, or it's got a lot of fruit. The best wines in the world balance all of those things, right? So because if it was all about fruit, somewhere else would be better. If it was all about oak, you know, it would be something else. If it was all about whatever. But if you taste the wines that people consider great, when you taste them, you go, oh my God, I really like this wine. It's a really good wine. And then you think about it. Well, yeah, the oak and the tannin and the fruit and the acidity and the bitterness are all balanced together to make a harmonious wine. And that to me is what we strive for every day. It's not about the big blousy. It is about elegance, purity, and harmony in the wines. And so that starts in the vineyard where you manage the vineyard, you manage your yields, and you get the perfect fruit. And then when you come in, you marry that winemaking, the things you do from winemaking, whether it's malolactic fermentation, whether it's all the other things that you can do in the winery, the oak age bearing, oak barrel aging, to get a balanced wine, right? And our philosophy is we've got a beautiful, unbelievable vineyard that I'll argue is the best in Niagara. And the only thing my winemaker can do is screw up that fruit. And their job really is to carry that fruit through to make the best possible wine. And that's what we try and do every day.
Before we get back to geography, I just realized in your last answer, I also went to McMaster. I was too short to be a basketball player, but I did the I did the play-by-play for the football team for the local radio station.
So when were you doing that?
I was, that was like 97, 98. And then even after I graduated, I did it for about 6-7 years afterwards. So yeah, I was there.
Yeah. You're a little bit after my time. I'm a little bit older than you, obviously.
And when I got there, the football team actually finally got good in my first couple of years. Yeah. Woof. It was really bad. But yeah, we have similar backgrounds. Both went to McMaster, who knew nothing about wine at the age of 19. 20 Valley, that I believe that's where you guys are located. I was wondering if you could just tell people where is 20 Valley and what are the characteristics there that you think work so well for your varietals?
Yeah, so the 20 Valley sort of, you've got Niagara Falls, Niagara on the lake, and the western portion of the Niagara Peninsula where we can grow grapes is west of St. Catharines to Grimsby, essentially. So it's that span of QEW where that on your way to Niagara Falls. Where we specifically are is we're right on the bench. We're on the 20-mile bench. And so that is an important thing because we're right on the Niagara Escarpment. And not to get into a too boring grade 9 geography lesson. What's great about the bench is we were, so you can imagine, so first of all, we got great limestone. And everybody knows we've got this, the Niagara Escarpment is limestone, the best wines in the world, not always, but a lot of the best wines in the world come with limestone soils. So we have this amazing limestone soil right on the Niagara Escarpment. What's great about the bench itself, different than the flatter part of the Niagara Peninsula, is we were never underwater. And so you can imagine 10,000 years ago, the glaciers recede. All is left is rock. And then mosses, grasses, shrubs, trees would grow. And there would become our soil versus the flatter part of the peninsula, where the shore of Lake Ontario was right at the base of the Niagara Escarpment. And so you've got a heavier clay and sandier soil on the flat part, and you've got this beautiful, I'll say, untouched soil that is on the bench. And that really makes the bench very unique.
That, not boring at all. And whenever anyone listens to this podcast or listens to wine podcasts, we all crave a little bit of the geography because we're always just curious. Why does this wine taste like this? And that's not the only reason, but it's always, it's part of the reason. So,
So just the why to me is always important. Right?
Yeah.
I always try and train my staff not to say, hey, this is our barrel cellar, right? Or we use French oak, right? It's always, why do we age wine in barrels? Why do we use French oak barrels? You know, it's always the, why do we temperature control our fermentation? Why do we handpick our grapes? It's never we handpick our grapes because the consumer may not know why that is important to the ultimate quality of the wine. So to me, the why is very important part of the education and learning about wine.
How much money would you save if you machine harvested everything?
So it would cut my harvest costs by at least 40%, mm-hmm. if not more.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of money.
And if people wonder why, oh, a Canadian wine for $33, there's a $16 bottle of Napa Cabernet Sauvignon from, you know, the choicest areas, and it's only $18. One of the reasons is your hand picking.
Yeah. Well, it's not just the hand picking. Look, I'll argue our wine is the best value in the world. Like this to me is one of the crazy things, you know. Ontarians, Canadians, I'll say in general, central Canadians, we love to dump on ourselves. You know, we got to be successful somewhere else in the world, but until then, we're going to hammer our own locally. And that, your comment about, oh, why would I pay $30 for an Ontario wine when I can get a $10 Chilean or an $18 California? And I'll tell you why, because we make amazing wine. The problem is, the mindset is I want to compare to the cheap. No. Compare me to the expensive. Compare me to Burgundy. Compare me to New Zealand Pinot Noir. Compare me to Oregon Pinot Noir. Compare me to Burgundy Chardonnay. Now you're talking, I can get an $80 Burgundy, the equivalent of an $80 Burgundy, for $30, right?
Yeah.
That's what we do in Ontario. That's the difference of what we do. You know, we were just in... late last year, we were in the Wine Spectator, and we got a 92 for our Gravity Pinot Noir. And it was in the California Cab edition. And so there's all these California Cabs with scores lesser than ours, right, at 10 times the price, right? Like, it's crazy, right? Like, when you look at what the ratings for Burgundy and Oregon and New Zealand are, and you compare those prices to our prices, I believe firmly, we offer the best value Pinot Noir in the world right now, full stop.
I agree.
It's a different question.
Yeah, I agree. As someone who's been drinking a lot more single vineyard Ontario Pinots, and listen, spending $38 on a bottle of wine, that's not cheap. I'm a professional uncle, so I can spend a little bit more money on wine, but you can taste them. And, you know, they do. They stand. It's not about, I love that point there. It's not about going against the $10 bottle of wine. How does it compare with a high-end Village or a Premier Cru Burgundy? And that's what the measuring stick should be at.
Yeah, well, let me tell you a story. So I had two French winemakers from Domaine de la Vougeray and Jean-Claude Boisset at my winery. And they were taking them down into the cellar. We're tasting out a barrel. And they looked at me and they said, Ed, how much do you charge for these wines? And I said, at the time, it would have been $17 and $25 because we didn't know which one they were going into at that time. But it was Chardonnay and that was what we would charge. And they started laughing. And I'm like, what's so funny about that? And they're like, well, if I could put a Burgundy label on these wines, I could get 5-6 times as much for them. And I didn't think that was all that funny.
So no.
About 9 months later, so the funny part of this story is 9 months later, I get a call from my staff. I remember I was driving home from Toronto. They said, we just won a gold medal in the International Wine Spirits Competition in London, England. So the biggest wine competition in the world. And I was so excited. I drive home. I get on my computer. I go online and I look. And in order was Domaine de la Vougeray, Clos Vougeot Monopole, gold. 250 euros. Jean-Claude Boisset, Pouilly Montrachet, gold, 180 euros. Flat Rock Cellars, the Rusty Shed Chardonnay, 18 euros. So they were wrong. They could charge 5-6 times as much. they could charge 10 times as much. And that to me is what we do, right? Like we don't, you put it in that context, right? Yeah, okay, it's got the history and it's got the name and it's got the demand. But in terms of the quality of wine, what we make here is as good as, I'll argue anywhere, particularly for the varieties we do well, Chard, Pinot, Riesling, I'll put them up against anywhere in the world, and that's what we do here in Ontario. So it's a really a different, we've got to change the mindset of people saying, oh my God, I'm paying $38 or whatever it is. It's, oh my God, I get this amazing wine, and it's I can't get that from Burgundy at this price point.
I think part of it's an Ontario thing. Like BC, they're much more supportive of their wine industry. It's something here in Ontario. It's I mean, I think part of it, you know, it's why so many Ontarians, you know, they don't like the CFL. They're like, oh, it's not like the NFL. Yeah. And it actually, you know, you had a quote in the Wall Street Journal in 2014 saying Canadians are not very good at promoting themselves. I imagine you feel the same way now, 6 years later.
Absolutely. Look, the number of times I hear when people come into the winery and go, and they taste the wine, they go, oh my, this is pretty good for an Ontario wine, right? And it's actually just a pretty good wine. Like stop even trying to qualify it, right? And it's one of the things I think we do here is we drink, I call it drinking with our eyes, right? Instead of tasting the wine and going, oh my God, I really like this. We try and rationalize, you know, it's this price. It got this score. It's from this producer, right? And we rationalize our thought process on how much we're going to like this wine before we even taste it. Then when we taste it, we're already discounting it because it's from Ontario. Oh, it's, you know, it's not very expensive or it's not a great producer. Just taste the wine. If you like it, drink more of it. If you don't worry about it. There's tons of great wines out there.
Yeah, rationalizing our joy seems like a bad idea. And let's totally. Face it. You know who the worst is? This is a man problem. So many guys I know, and they're, you know, and not even people close to me, but I'll be out for dinner with other people like, ah, Ontario. I like my wines to be bigger. I'm not going to drink the light stuff there. And I don't like, I used to get angry. Now I'm more like, listen, I want you to try it, not because of some sort of nationalistic thing, but because it's good and it'll bring you joy. But it's usually dudes. This is usually a dude thing.
It totally is, right? So I'll give you, guys are very, it's the image, right? And so did I pay a lot for the wine? Hey, I paid $50 for this wine, right? Or it comes from this fancy schmancy place or whatever it is, right? And it totally is a guy problem. Women are much more practical. The other one for me is we're 100% screw cap, right? And so.
Oh, I was getting there. I was getting there.
Okay. But guys are always like, oh, but it's much more romantic to open up a bottle of wine that's with a cork. And I'm like, if that's the best you can do for romance, buddy, you got bigger problems. Right? And women are much more practical. They're just like, let's crack it open and go. And again, when I talk about screw cap, I don't denigrate cork. I've made a conscious decision to use screw cap because I believe it is the best closure for wine. I've done a lot of research in it. Wines age better. They guarantee that the wine I make is going to be the wine that you drink. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why I believe it's better. Now, I took a big risk because of the perception of screw cap versus cork. And I continue to fight that battle, although now it's a lot better and a lot easier than it was 17 years ago, 20 years ago when I had to make that decision. But I'm a fervent believer that it is the best closure. But again, it is those preconceived notions. Oh, that wine has a screw cap on it, so it can't be as good. If you research, just type in Chateau Margaux screw cap study. Mm-hmm. And they did a study, I think from 2003 to 2013 or 5 to 15, but a 10-year study. Chateau Margaux's own conclusion was that their wines age better in screw cap. Their own conclusion.
But they can't do right? it. They can't change
but
it.
But they can't do it. They no, can't change it, right? Like, it's amazing. Yeah, yeah it's yeah. like, it, okay, so you concluded that your wines age better in the screw cap.
Doesn't matter.
And they can't make the change. It's mind-boggling to me. But again, that's the old world way of thinking, and then that's the challenges that you know they face, I'll argue, in that old world thinking.
And I can't remember the name of the producer, but there is one producer in Burgundy, and even their Grand Cru, they throw a screw cap on it. So you see these little moments of it. And I mean, I get high-end Gimlet Gravels, North Island, Bordeaux blends and Syrahs with screw caps. It's fine.
Yep. Yeah. I'm telling you, I can look, I've got a library full of wines that will demonstrate to you quite clearly that wines age in screw cap much better. I remember there was a owner no longer in the industry here in Ontario, but we did every year we do this cuvée tasting in March where the industry comes together. Brock University organizes it, and they'll do a theme for that year. I think that year was Chardonnay, and I had a bunch of older Chardonnays that I gave them all with screw cap. By the time he finished the tasting, he made the decision to go to screw cap because he could taste just how much better the wines were in screw cap than in cork. And that's really, it's to me, it's easy to prove, but it's hard to get people's heads around.
Oh yeah. Well, part of it's because with wine, people get nervous or insecure. And so they're just going to hold on to the traditions. You right. know, is it cheaper? Is screw cap cheaper than cork?
No, depends. You can get a more expensive cork. So if you want to get a super, you could probably pay upward of about 30. Screw cap cost me about 18 cents. Mm-hmm. A cork can cost anywhere from about 4 cents to about 30, 35 cents.
Right? Okay.
So yeah. Sort of in the middle. I would say most people who are using cork are probably using a cork that's less expensive than my screw cap. But, you know, for, you know, Chateau Margaux, for example, probably uses a really expensive cork.
They better. So I don't know if you can talk about it. When I was doing my research, I found there was a lawsuit between you guys and a brewery in Oregon.
Yeah.
And I love this quote. They sued. We lost. New name. Same great wine. Enjoy. I'd love to hear the story of you versus the brewery.
Yeah. So we had a wine called The Rogue. I named it after my dad. And my dad taught me a lot of things obviously in life, and I wanted to celebrate him because he taught me to challenge norm. Just because it's the way things have been done for years, decades, or whatever, it doesn't mean that's the best way to do it, and always try and find ways to do things better. And so I named the wine The Rogue after him. And there's Rogue Ales out of Oregon, and they sent me a cease and desist. You can't use Rogue. We fought it here in Canada, because the way I looked at it is ours was The Rogue, and we had a little caricature done of my dad, so it was a noun. Theirs is Rogue Ales, is a adjective, and they're in beer, and I'm in wine. And lo and behold, shocking to me, our trademark office up in Ottawa sided with the Americans and not with us, which I thought we had a legitimate case to win anyways. But anyway, so we ended up losing, which is, you know, you win some, you lose some. And so we renamed the wine Trademark Infringement.
Yep.
And and had a little, so we had a little bit of fun with it. Like, wine should be fun, right? Like,
yeah.
It should be enjoyable. We shouldn't get uptight about it. I always think is when life throws you that roadblock, how do you go around it? How do you overcome it? We just had a little bit of fun with it.
Also, I'm thinking, like, who are these people at this brewery in Oregon? Are you that miserable with your life that that's the stuff you're going to pursue?
Yes, I agreed. It seems like a small winery up here in Ontario wouldn't catch the radar of us. And unfortunately, that's just the way they went about it. I think they live in a more litigious place, though, than us.
That is, absolutely. And one that... Well, we could get into COVID and masks for them, and especially the entire state of Florida. Thank God, by the way, thank God Florida is not a place that makes wine, or else, you know, then I think we'd all be even that much more scared. Of course, in sports right now, the Tampa Bay Rays. Anyway, enough about that.
Yes.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about the history of the cellar, of your father, and just how Flat Rock came to be.
My dad, when I was growing up, my dad would always visit farms. And I was like, why aren't we going to this farm on Sunday to look at farms? And eventually, as he was winding, because he grew up on a farm in Beamsville. And he eventually, in the probably early 90s, bought an apple farm outside of Hamilton. I grew up in Hamilton, just in Copetown. And he had this apple farm. And eventually, he sold the apple farm. And we were lucky to fall upon this place. I know I was working for a big wine company at the time, and they were looking to purchase this piece of land as well. And it was a local farmer who owned the land, and he decided to sell it to my dad because they just resonated farmer to farmer. And so my dad bought the bought the property. So I was lucky enough to have a property paid for. And Farm Credit Canada lends to silly farmers who, and so we borrowed the money to build the winery. And that's how we got started. And so my dad, I'll say, is on the, he is in the land, my dad, and I'm on the business side of it. So I've developed the brand, the name, and open up the winery. I would say that's how we started. And my dad to this day is still my chairman of the board. When I need advice, he's a great place to go to get advice on what to do in certain situations.
You mentioned Riesling a couple times. I was wondering if you could let's continue this with your dad and the history. When was the decision made? Why was the decision made to do, to focus? And it makes sense, but the decision making behind Riesling, Chard, Pinot, that's where your focus is going to be.
So that, I'll say, primarily came from me. I was in the working for a big wine company. I was managing Inniskillen at the time. And so I had a lot of insight into what was happening, what were the successful varieties we were growing. I would talk to the winemakers in the company. I obviously did a lot of my own homework. So that sort of decision, my dad, you know, we were sitting down, he goes, well, so what do we plant on this land if we're going to plant? And we were always going to be, my plan was always, we were going to grow grapes, we were going to sell the grapes. And then when I was 55, I would then do a winery, right?
Right.
And so just, you know, there is a story to it, but one thing led to another. You know, we planted with the varieties that we planted, which was, looking back, obviously was the right decision. I remember at the time people were looking at us like we were crazy. Like, why are you planting three varieties? Like, you here in Ontario, we plant a little bit of this, a little bit of that, because it covers everything, and that's what you do in Ontario. And I said, no way, we're going to plant these varieties. And the other one they thought we were crazy was Pinot Noir, because at the time, you got to remember, we have a grape growing, we have a great marketing board. And what that means is the marketing board basically sets the price. It's negotiated, but it's a set price for the grapes. So you, a grower, let's say, knows they're going to get 2 tons per acre for Pinot Noir.
Right.
Well, if you crop it at 10 tons, that's $20,000. If you crop it at 2 tons, that's $4,000. If you're a grower, which one do you want to do? Makes sense. You're going to crop it higher.
Yeah.
So, at, you know, so 20 years ago, there were much fewer wineries, and there was and they were buying a lot of grapes. And so everybody thought Pinot Noir was not a good grape variety for Ontario because it was always overcropped. And you'll notice Pinot Noir from anywhere in the world does not, you can't get a 50. Pinot Noir is never under $15, because what happens with is as you increase the yield of Pinot Noir, so you take more tons per acre, you decrease the quality. But you hit 3 tons an acre, you make an insipid, terrible wine. And so that's what everybody thought. But I said, we're going to grow Pinot Noir, we're going to crop it low, and we're going to make amazing quality Pinot Noir. And that was a huge change to how Ontario viewed Pinot Noir. And thankfully, it worked out, because you're seeing that it is a great variety here in Ontario when cropped low, done, taken care of, and done properly. And so it's been a big change, and I think a successful one for the entire industry.
Flat Rock Cellars is a gorgeous place. It's been actually been a couple of years since I've been there. But I'm just wondering, as we end this, how is it with you guys right now with COVID in terms of tastings, tours? Obviously, everyone's having to adjust. So what's going on at Flat Rock Cellars?
Yeah, so we're lucky. So one, we've opened very responsibly. We've got a whole protocol system, and we've got a set of guidelines for all the staff that they have to review and sign off on. And, you know, the priority for me is obviously my employees and my customers. So we take every precaution to be able to allow people to enjoy and experience Flat Rock Cellars in a very safe manner. We're lucky because we've got a lot of space, and so we can do tastings outside, obviously when the weather permits, and it's been hot and sunny. So we do tastings outside. Everybody is way more than 6 feet apart. Our staff is wearing masks, and we're doing all of that. So that has been obviously a bit of a change. I look at it as an opportunity. Remember when I said earlier, when you hit a roadblock, you know, how do you overcome it?
Yeah.
So this roadblock for me says we can actually deliver, we are actually forced, which is a great thing, to deliver a more personalized, more intimate, and I say intimate, not close, but more detailed experience. Because now, rather than grouping, you know, three couples and a group of four into a group of 10, we can only take a couple at a time, right? And so you book your tour and tasting with us, you will have a dedicated person that's there concentrating on you. So you get a much more personalized, focused experience in this era of COVID. So I think we're adapting in that sense. And then one of the other things that's happened that I'll think surprised everybody in our industry is direct to consumer. People ordered online like crazy. It was, you know, people were staying at home and hopefully that stays. And because I think it's a great way. I always said, like, you know, if it's over a certain amount, you get free shipping. But even if it's under, I think our shipping is $10. It costs you that much in gas to go to the bloody store, right? And you can sit at home and it's dropped off at your door. So, you know, it's a great way to get wine. And it really has changed. In the U.S., they've been ahead of us in terms of direct to consumer. And it's just interesting that COVID really amped up our online ordering.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I've only been in the LCBO, I think, once, and that was because I had to pick up a specific bottle. But I've done everything through either consignment companies or buying straight from wineries, just supporting local consignment companies. So yeah, I've pretty much stopped going into the LCBO.
Yeah, no, and that's great, and I think that's the other thing we've seen is a lot more support of local, and I hope that translates, right? Like, I really hope that we see the lift, and then that lift continues because people have been able to experience local wine and go, hey, wow, this is much better than I thought it was.
Ed, I really appreciate you joining me on the podcast today. Really a fun talk and an interesting talk, and I say it all the time. I hope people that listen to this just open their eyes to what Ontario can bring you.
Yeah, and my comment will be is close your eyes, open your heart, and that's what will change the tide, in my opinion.
Thank you so much, Ed.
Awesome. Thanks, Matthew.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.